Welcome everyone to today's lecture, Compiler Construction 1. First of all, let me introduce me for a short while. My name is Michael Petter. I am one of the postdocs at Helmut Seidel's chair. I'm reading compiler construction since 4 years now, and before that I have done a lot of projects in compiler construction with students and also for research projects. I have been involved in compilers for C, for OCaml, for COBOL, for assembler sublanguages and all that. So that is why I start the first few lectures here in compiler construction. At roughly the middle of the semester, we will switch over to Dr. Axel Simon, which will tell you in the second half a little bit about code generation, which is one of his research topics. So let's first start a little bit about organizational stuff. First of all, let's talk about whether you're right here in this course. This course is for either master students or bachelor students in their final year. What we will need for you to know is about the introductory courses, Informatik 1 and 2. We will need knowledge from theoretical and computer science. There's also aspects of technical computer science in here, and also we will have quite a lot of algorithms going on there, so it would be beneficial for you to have a knowledge about basic algorithms. If you find that the topics that we discuss here are quite pleasing and you would like to know more, you should, or you have a chance to delve a little bit deeper in the next semesters. For example, with program optimization, with virtual machines, which is read actually Mondays and Tuesdays this semester. There's also the chance to hear programming languages, which is kind of not starting with the basics, but treats semantics and compiler aspects of programming constructs that are too much for this course, and thus deserve to be treated in another lecture. There's also the lab course, the practical course in compiler construction. This year we will, for example, do a PowerPC backend for the LLVM. I think it starts as a blocked course in the middle of the, this semester. And of course there's also seminars that you can take here, for example, next winter, which treats the which is borderline compiler construction and hardware architecture. So yeah, it's kind of a mixture of both topics. If you attend this lecture, you you will find our recordings of the lectures with the usual teleteaching tool techniques. So there is this website, ttt.in.tum.de, where you can download the recordings of these lectures and consume them once again at home if you realize that you have not understood everything at the first try. You can have a second try at home. But I would really beg you to if I'm too fast for you, or I'm if I do too complex stuff here, please ask. Especially in the first part of the course, we will have topics that that grow from date to date, and we will have you will have a quite hard time to understand what's going on if you leave me talking while you don't understand one of the pieces that I explained to you. So please don't hesitate. Don't think you're stupid if you ask a question. there's almost every time someone else in the room who also has problems with that. So please ask also if you have problems with language, if I'm not speaking loud enough, or if you don't understand a word and want me to explain it once again, please ask. Yeah. What I will also give you is, of course, the slides that I have prepared for you. As this is not the first lecture, the first time that we give this lecture, the slides are already pretty well-rounded and won't change too much over the years. So if you want to take annotations or something on paper, you can always go back to the last years and get last year's version of the slides and mark the changes. It's not so much, so you can always do with these. Yeah, there's also, well, it's called related literature list. Essentially, the topics that we're going to cover in this lecture is meanwhile available in one book. So that is one that should be either in German or in English available, either in the library or I think it is also downloadable as a PDF if you go through the TUM proxies. So there should be no problem in obtaining a copy of that. Of course, there's also the slides and the recordings. What we will also use as materials is a few tools to visualize certain aspects of compiler construction, like there's tools for virtual machine, kind of, yeah, that simulate the runtime of these machines and draws you the memory layout and the stack layout of the current program state. And yeah, that will be used. We will also use a few tools that do the usual jobs in compiler construction, like scanner generator or parser generator. So that is also something that you need, but that will be probably covered a little bit better by the tutorials, which will be given by Kalmar Apinis in the first half of the semester. You can find him on the same chair's homepage as this course and also me. But the dates, this lecture will start 2:15 and end 4:15. And for a tutorial, with this size, there will be approximately enough people interested in tutorials that we can set up two tutorial courses. There will be voting in the Moodle part of this homepage, where of this course, where you can submit your personal preferences for one time slot. So this will be registered by Kalmar and made into course dates. One thing that I should stress beforehand, because this is often seen as unusual by students, is that for this course we will have one exam in the summer and none in the winter. So if you plan to get credits for the whole thing, I would advise you to really come to the tutorial sessions and attend them. I'm not determining the date myself. I get them from the central, as you also do via this TUM online thing. So I don't know exactly, but there is a time slot where all these exams have to take place. I think it's 3 weeks after the semester or something. I don't know whether anyone else. Yeah, but there's an allocated time slot for exactly this thing where all the exams for one semester should take place, and we will get an ordinary date in there. One thing, although there will be only technically one exam per person, if you have overlapping exams or anything else which hinders you on exactly this date, please tell us. we will try to come up with an alternative date for you in this case. So there's no need to refrain from taking part in this exam just because the date is not pleasant for you. We will try to set up another date for you in this case. But in sum, we will only have one date per student. Okay. You can also earn yourself a bonus on your grade of a third of a grade by submitting the tutorial exercises. You need to achieve 50% of the credits. As far as I know, the mode is that you get presented with the tutorial sheet. You get the chance to work on that only just based on the knowledge that you gain from the lecture. Then there will be the tutorial session where you can follow how the technique would be for these exercises, and then you have again the chance to resubmit. But in this case, you need there's a cap on the number of points that you can get, which is smaller than the one that you could have got when you submitted beforehand. So you have a chance to get explanations before you submit, but this will amount in a smaller number of points there. But I think for details you should ask Kalmar. I think he should probably also explain that on the Moodle page. So, about general organizational stuff. Yes? It will be a written exam for the cases where you have overlapping other exams. I think this depends on how many of those we will get, but in case we will only get one or two, we will also do them orally.
And is it 2 hours written exam or 1 hour?
90 minutes. So, yes. You can submit anytime, so that's you don't have necessary to be there. You just have to submit, but it should be two different time slots. So we hope to cover a decent amount of you. Yes. Sorry. Because this takes a lot of effort. And I need to do research at some place and some time. But there is the we will try to make it in a way that if you really want to pass the exam, and if you take the tutorial sessions, I try to design the exercises in such a way that you can really pass this. If you're referring to the Prüfungsordnung, you should once again check exactly what's standing there. There's certain types of courses, and this is one of these optional courses for which we do not need to provide every year. Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Is it possible to submit the exercises in Teams or
no? Wow. I don't exactly know. I have to ask Kalma for this, but yeah, me myself, I don't know. I think it will be, well, probably you have to submit alone, but maybe when the groups are too large, he might decide to group you into two persons groups, but I think there won't be anything larger. Okay. So let's continue. At first, let's talk a little bit about what the whole course will be about and what parts of compiler construction you will see, so that you've got an impression on what you should know afterwards after you have attended to this course. So I've already mentioned that there's connections to theoretical computer science. So you probably not so surprised when you see something like basics of regular expressions and automata once again in there. That's to this is because, well, parts of the whole system works based on these concepts, and we need to come to a common starting ground. With that, this in mind, we will talk about how to specify a scanner and what the implementation of such a scanner really does. We will, the whole thing will be split in first this theoretical part, and then how to get the whole generator thing right, because scanners are in general generated pieces of code, and yeah. In this course, we won't talk about how the scanner will work. That's something that you already know from theoretical computer science, but how to generate this scanner. After that, we will continue with the next phase in such a compiler, which is dealing with reduced context-free grammars and pushdown automata. So once again, you have a connection to theoretical computer science, but as before, we will treat these topics from the perspective as a compiler's generators, which will mean that, yeah, in our case, we will generate pushdown automata out of context-free grammars, and the idea is not how to get pushdown automata working, but how to get a generator for pushdown automata running, and yeah, that is the second core competence that we'll see here. And we will talk about bottom-up syntax analysis, which is kind of the state of the art of what parser generators in present are using as a technique for doing syntax analysis. This is a little bit more complicated than the naive approach that we will have beforehand when we talk about pushdown automata, but that is kind of the technique that you will need for certain complex grammars. After this, we will have a change in lecturer, and you, Axel Simon will continue with topics. At first, we will, or he will then talk about attribute systems, which are systems that that are used by compilers to gather information that is not in a manner that it would be hierarchical or something, but kind of gathered from several places inside one of these source code files. So that's what attribute systems are used for. One of the examples where they are used is type checking, so that will be the kind of application topic for attribute systems. And after that, we will have all the knowledge we need for analyzing source code. The next few topics are about how to do the output of a compiler, which means how to generate code from our internal representation. And the course of that, we will take a look at how code generation for stack machines work in context of all the typical expressions and statements that appear in a language like C. We will then also switch over to the topic of what changes when you introduce registers on your machine. and come up with a different cogeneration scheme for that. And also, I think we will have a few spotlights on selected basic optimizations, at least when the time is still sufficient for that. But we hope that this will happen. Okay. Any questions about the contents? Okay. So let's start. At first, the introduction. The first part is about what a compiler is actually, what a compiler actually is. So, yeah, what would you say? What does a compiler do?
Compile.
Which means?
I think it checks first if the grammar you give for the language is correct, and then it translates into machine instructions.
So you say it has a certain output for once, which is machine instructions in most cases. Okay, so the purpose of a compiler is, in case of, at least for these machine language translators, is to produce machine code. Okay, the other thing, the grammars, I think, is not at this point the thing. If you see it as a kind of a transformation going on, the input is a kind of source file. Or
yeah, I think yeah. You have a program and perhaps user input, and this is compiled then into yeah, machine code, and this is the output then.
So we have, that's already assuming probably most of this slide, we have components like there's the program itself, then there's the output, the machine code, most parts, and there's also another thing which is the input. And yeah, in a system where you want to process data or run programs, you always need some way to come from your actual program to machine code. And with yeah, now it depends on which kind of architecture you choose to use. If you use one that also consumes the input in some way, you will have chosen an architecture which is similar to an interpreter. So what an interpreter does, it takes the program, it takes also the input, and then starts to interpret this program in context of this input and tries to progress in the program until a point where it needs input, consumes the next input, runs further, and this way while reading the program on the fly, generates the machine instructions, or kind of, yeah, triggers the machine to do something. That is what the interpreter does. What is the properties of that is? Well, in this case, this is something that's pretty straightforward. That's something that we as programmers do when we read program code. We start reading with the program until we come to a point where we see that there's further information needed, so we think of something like the input that may flow into and then continue on. What is the great advantage of the whole thing? You don't have to pre-compute too much. You can start right away with executing your task. And there's no long delay for startup time. But also there's a downside of this kind of executing programs, which means that, yeah, you can imagine that at a certain point you come, you can continue in several ways. Either one way where you have to kind of look up something now at the moment to do it more optimized way, or do it but then you need to investigate, invest in. Time to find out how to optimize the next few steps. So that is something that the interpreter has to do a lot of times. You have to analyze the program that you read on the fly. You have at certain points you have to dig deeper into the libraries, what's actually happening there. You have to come up with ways how to, if you see certain instructions, for example, that you could easily just omit because they don't have any effect on the program. In an interpreter, you just execute them in a straight manner, or you need time to find out whether these instructions are really having no effect on the computation, and that's what the interpreter is challenged with. Yeah. The other way is the way where you say, well, for runtime, we want to have very short delays. We don't want to invest too much time in optimization at runtime because we want the program to react fast. In these cases, you probably will choose another architecture where you have two separate phases of your translation. At first, you will have the you start with a program and give it to your compiler, and this compiler has the purpose of coming up with a version of the program which is already processed with the pre it tries to do as much as it can in terms of program optimizations with only the program as its input. So it tries to come up with detecting possibly dead branches of conditions that might never be true or something, and tries to throw them away immediately. It tries to inline subroutine calls. It tries to come up with a clever way of storing and managing data structures and all that, and it does that already beforehand and comes up with a very concise and precise incarnation of this program, and most times already in machine code format. And then the interpreter is reduced to just being the machine itself, which gets the code and the input and then runs much faster as the version that you've seen in the interpreter. So there's two phases. There's the translation phase of the program text, which is also called the static phase of such a program. And there's also the actual execution of the program. And this is the kind of dynamic phase of the whole system where data might change because the input is only determined very late in the whole system when the program is already actually running. So that is introducing a lot more dynamics in the whole system. So that's the dynamic phase. Okay, so these are the two very general concepts of what such a compiler does. In general, what the goal is that you have three components, which is source program, you have user input, and you have as an output the triggering the machine processes. Okay. Yeah. Both of these systems use techniques from this course, which we will learn in compiler construction. It's only a matter of how to assemble and them to one big runtime module. And there are certain consequences on which ways you can organize your data and on which invariants you can rely at which time. So yeah, there's a few differences in those two concepts of executing programs, but most of the times you will end up with a kind of compromise. There's, for example, if you take something like a virtual machine-based language, C Sharp or C++ or something, you will have components from both both flavors. You will have a static phase where there's classical compiler techniques used to come up with a very concise bytecode representation of your program. And then there's the virtual machine phase, which is running this bytecode and still doing compiler techniques in optimizing your program, this time on the run. And yeah, so in most cases, you will get something like a hybrid system in modern times. There's also situations where system which is interpreted can be even faster than one that is statically compiled, in cases where you, for example, have input from the user at the very beginning for initializing certain variables which don't change anymore to the during the rest of the program. And a virtual machine can then assume, as soon as it has the input, that this will be constants and might very aggressively optimize the program at that point of time, and then execute only a very very optimized version. So, yeah, there's upsides and downsides to both of these things. So, in general, either way, you need some way to come from program code to machine code. So how can you achieve that? In general, we split this large module, which is a compiler, into several submodules. The first of them are kind of task-driven. At first, you need to come up with what your input really means. So you have to analyze your source code. So there's an analysis phase at the very beginning, which produces as internals some kind of representation. So you have your source code in a more data structure oriented way in memory. And then in the next phase, you do the synthesis of your machine code. Yeah. And what also comes into play is that these modules are still quite large, so we can split them even more. So let's do that for the analysis phase. The analysis phase, we start from the program code, and our goal is to have some intermediate form in which we can more easily decide what kind of code we want to produce or what kind of optimizations we want to do. So in many of these compilers, you will find at least at some place something like an annotated syntax tree in there, which is a kind of hierarchical representation of your input. But how to come up with such a thing? Well, there's different submodules involved in that. There's, for example, the first phase, which is the scanner module. And the scanner module does very primitive classification of your input in the sense that the scanner gets as an input the whole program code as one string, which is just a large array of somewhat coded text. And what it produces is a stream of small units, and these units are called token in this case, and each of these units are the kind of the basic components of your programming language. If you think of, for example, Java, you will have keywords, for example, like something like void or int or while, which are kind of very small basic units that might occur in your program. So that is what the scanner produces. It takes the whole large string of your program and chops it into small units for further use by the next compiler phase, which is the parser. The parser operates on the stream that it gets handed over by the scanner. So remember, you have now a stream of small units. You don't have to decide anymore where you separate them from each other. And the purpose of the parser is to come up with the structure that relates these small units. So what the parser does is it has general information that comes from something like a grammar. That's something that you already said. So there's information about the language that you're actually at the moment compiling, and adhering to the rules that that are found in this language specification, it assembles from the units that it finds in this token stream an hierarchy, in the sense of it creates a tree. So this tree is called the syntax tree. I guess probably most of you have already seen one. Is there anyone who had introduction to informatic one with something like syntax trees in there and grammar things and all that? Who of you has? Okay, this is already quite a lot. So you've already seen something like a syntax tree already. That is some concept that that we have in these introductory courses to get. Yes. Ah, to the token stream. Right.
So, is it already somehow optimized, for example, that is the white space removed, or is, for example, long variable names somehow chopped down into small words, or is it really the token stream means that if I have a long variable name, that I have something like variable names still inside?
At this stage, it's not really determined whether you have to do that, but this is clearly an aspect that is important when we. More in detail on the scanner, and there is scanners that already do that, but there's also a concept of something that is in between, which is called a kind of a siever, who kind of tries to keep certain tokens from passing to the next phase, like comments or white spaces or something. So there's different ways to implement these architectures, but in general, the concept is that there's a phase which produces units, and the next thing that produces trees. But yeah, that's an aspect that is important in that case. Yeah, so there's syntax trees, and what's else of interest when you do analysis of input code? Well, there's properties that are clearly not hierarchical, that you cannot really capture in a tree-like structure. So, yeah, now I would have liked to ask you whether you can come up with a property that is not hierarchical, but I think I uncovered the next item too fast. You see already mentioned that there's the example of a type checker. That is one of the informations that is not a hierarchical property. Why is that? Well, you have a sequence of statements, for example, and you have something that happens before, which is a declaration, for example, and then a few statements later, you have to decide whether you have already declared this name as a variable or not, and there's no father-son connection between these two statements, so to say. So that is something that cannot be captured with plain hierarchical information. So that is, for example, one of the tasks that still needs to be done, although we already have a syntax tree. There's perfectly fine syntax trees that are not able to be processed further because there's type errors still in there. So if you consider one of the IDEs that, of your choice, now when you get the error messages, you have or should have a rough idea of in which phase of the input interpretation an error that you see might have happened. So errors that, like, well, what is this? Is this a unit? That is something that is produced by the scanner. Errors that say, well, in this context, it's not valid to use a certain keyword, for example. That is an error message that comes from the parser, and messages like, well, I could not find any type for this identifier. Please check your definitions. That's something that comes from the semantic analysis. Okay, so. To delve deeper into the whole system, we now have a look at these components one after each other. So let's start with the most basic of all, which is the lexical analysis. The general idea is that we start from a string that represents the program code, and we end with a sequence of units that is made up from this program code, and that is what our scanner should do. So, in an example, our scanner might find some expression like this one here. And what it does is, well, it tries to find units. So, yeah, there's a lot of characters here. But as soon as they hit a white space, our scanner might decide that, oh, now I've found one of these units that we need. So let's create one of them. So it creates unit here. Then the next one will be, for example, the plus. Then there's this number. So that is the general purpose of what a scanner has to do. We have already talked about that there's these units that are there in all programming languages. In the context of compiler construction, we call these small units tokens, and these tokens are essentially sequences of characters, and the thing is that they are not only sequences, because that would just partition my input, but the scanner does these partitions not randomly, but it does it with purpose. It finds these tokens because it has a certain idea of how our units are composed and what kinds of units are there. So these tokens are not only sequences of characters, but they also have been created with a certain idea of a token, of a whole class of tokens in mind. And the scanner doesn't let the next phase decide once again what this class has been, but because it has already decided where to chop the input, it also marks the tokens with the class it has come up with while breaking up the input. So tokens are made from sequences of characters, and they're also carrying with themselves a marker to which class the whole thing belongs. If you implement such a scanner, you would come up with probably things like number codes for certain classes of tokens. What are examples for these classes? Well, you've seen me already breaking up the input and talking about certain concepts like white spaces in between, or numbers, which are in this case constants. There can be different kinds of constants, but all of them belong to certain classes. So there's integer constants, there's floating number constants, but there's also other constants, or also literals like character literals. Yeah, what we've used as the very first token is something that might be used for a variable name or a function name or method name. All of these names are called kind of identifiers, and they also adhere to certain rules how they are formatted. They start with something like a letter or an underscore or a dollar symbol or anything that is not a number. So they have a certain shape. Then there's things like operators. So when you specify expressions, you might want to have some combining operators. Yes. I'm really sorry. This is really happening one after the other. So the typing is done when the scanning is finished. Well, I say so now, but in practice you might encounter systems where there's a little bit of interleaving going on. So this separation into several phases is in practice not always something that you can use for certain languages. There are languages that need your type checker to run already during the hierarchical analysis. But for most cases of practical languages, and especially the ones that were designed on the blackboard or whiteboard, they are designed in a way that you can clearly separate the faces from each other, and that the typing has nothing to do with something like scanner or parser. But there's the aspect of something like a type already hidden a little bit into the scanner. You're completely right. You already have kind of something like a basic type information, like this is for sure an integer number, for example. And by the length of the character sequence alone, you can already determine whether you you will treat this as a long literal or a short literal or an integer or a double or whatever. So there's basic type information already hidden in the shape of these character sequences. But type analysis does even more, because for composed expressions, for example, you also need something like a type, and that is something that you cannot purely read from the character sequences that you find in the input. So you need to do more.
Why are there exactly the types to be compared? Before the generating the ASP or like after the
You would do it afterwards, because the hierarchical information helps in finding, for example, declaration statements, and a statement is already something which is hierarchically constructed by itself. Okay. And also there's reserved terms that are also called it's a keyword, for example, like the if or the int or the while or something. So all these are classes of tokens, and the token themselves also carry their concrete incarnation, which is the lexeme in German. Okay. So now we see that the tokens are also annotated with their class information. So that is what the scanner actually produces. Yeah. On top of the whole thing, there will be also things that you can already do. I think you were asking about things like spaces, white spaces, comments, or something. And during the scanner phase, you can already decide about the importance of certain units of your source code. For example, most modern languages don't care how many times you press space before starting with a new statement. That has to do with the scanner phase, where all these white spaces are actually left out and not inserted into this unit or token stream, which is given to the next phase but already left out. So there's this job of sieving the tokens already on a very low level, which is often also done as a kind of separate, very little phase between the scanner and the parser, and then it's called a siever. But most of them are also already kind of mixed and melted into each other, so you can't really clearly say which component does the sieving and which component does the scanning job. But yeah, other things that you can already do on the level of scanning is that languages might carry very basic instructions on how this program has to be interpreted. Already is things like pragmas, which are used to configure the compiler at sometimes, or also there are kind of macros that are have to be executed before the complete compilation or the parsing does even start. So there's things that you can do already at the level of the unit stream. You might also do something like realizing that you have something like basic typing already and try to optimize the way in which you keep your tokens by, for example, introducing a string table, and if you have one string several times in your input, you only manage your reference into this string table instead of putting your whole possibly very lengthy string into your token. So that's things that you can already do at this level. You can also, for example, if you have already classified a token as a floating point number, for example, you don't need to save the concrete character sequence in the token, but you can already try to pre-process and include the actual number as a double into your token, so you don't need to convert them afterwards once again. So that's all things that you can do already on the level of a scanner. Yeah. So now that we know what a scanner in generally does, is, the question is, how can we come up with such a scanner? How can we reasonably do the process of scanning? Well, the thing is that we have all the knowledge that we need for doing something like scanning based on certain rules. With the knowledge that we have from theoretical computer science, we can manually start and just write a large program with if-then-else and switch tables, which tries to decide based on the identity of certain characters what token will be the one generated from the head of my remaining input. But that is something that is really tedious and takes a lot of time and is also quite error-prone. So especially when you plan to implement several programming languages that are different from each other, you might come up with the idea of, well, that is work that really bothers me and I don't want to do that repeatedly. I want to do something more clever. You start thinking and say that, yeah, there's a lot of boilerplate code inside this task of doing a scanner, and what the only thing that really changes from one scanner to the other is this specification of these tokens and the code that is provided by me that acts as a kind of callback whenever I have found a character sequence that matches my rule. So the general idea is, in this case, if you have come up with two spots that are changing and the rest is the same, you can try to use a template for the whole thing where you only put in the changing things. And that is something that is happening for scanner creation quite a lot. And this is the concept of using a generator. So you specify your token classes, give them to a generator, and it provides a scanner for you. In most cases, this specification is consisting of, for one thing, the information about the classes of the tokens, and also consisting of the callback code, which determines what the generated scanner should do when it has detected your token class in your input stream. In most cases, it will just try to produce a data structure that contains the detected character sequence and also the identifier for the class of this token. But yeah, you might do more special things like if you, for example, write a syntax highlighter or something that is not producing a token stream but produces a kind of HTML or whatever you choose for your highlighting. Yeah. What is the benefits of using strategies like this generator? Well, for once, you only need to concentrate on specifying the things that really change and not all the boilerplate code, so it will be probably quite fast and more productive. And also, you can do less errors in the boilerplate code that you would have to write otherwise. So the correctness will be probably, at least if your generator is correct, enhanced. And also, you don't have to, each time when you try to come up with a new scanner, you have if you do it manually, you have to think about the performance and efficiency and all that. If you use a generated piece of software, you will benefit from the optimizations that have gone into the generator each time that you generate your software. And also, you will benefit from future developments in your scanner generator because you can just rerun the generation process and get a more optimized version of your scanner for free. Okay. There's also disadvantages. You might say, well, productivity, ease of programming. Well, using something like a specification language for a scanner is also kind of programming, so where's the sense in that? I replaced one kind of program with the other. Yeah, that's well the point. The other thing is that, it might be quite a large overhead to get all the scanner infrastructure to run, and it might not pay off in all circumstances. But yeah, that's the two aspects of generating your software. Well, for our case, where we want to produce a scanner from a specification, we will come up with very basic rules for the different tokens. In this case, we will use, well, what's this? This is a kind of a regular expression here, and we will use regular expressions to specify classes of character sequences. And then we will give these specifications to a generator, and then this will generate us a, well, what is this? This is a finite automaton. So why do we want something like a finite automaton? What does that help us? We have to what somewhere?
We have to stop
somewhere. Yeah. So that's probably another aspect of the whole thing, but in this case, the usage would be exactly as you say. We would track the way that we go through this automaton while consuming input, and when we reach one of these endpoints, that's what you said, this will be one of the endpoints that is decided by the shape of the regular expression before that we use for classification. So as soon as we have reached the endpoint of something like this automaton, we know that we are in the input at a position where we match the classification that we gave via specification beforehand. Yes. But more concretely, what I wanted to point out is, well, having something like a finite automaton is always a nice thing, because you have to imagine all we need is we need to have a pointer on the state of the machine that we're already at the moment in, and we need a translation table of where to go in case we find the next input symbol. So something like a finite automaton is always a good thing. We only have table lookups and states that we can represent as something like an integer or something. So having a finite automaton is always a good thing, because it's very easy to implement. So it's actually it's doing the same. Regular expressions is nothing else than a finite automaton in terms of semantics, but we prefer to have one of these automata because it is something that we can quite easily implement, because it's just a table. And what is even better is that we can use the whole thing to make for mass generation, because what we need is we need a table interpreter, which is something which is really easy. We just need to provide our scanners with custom tables when we want to write custom scanners. So that's pretty handy for lexical analysis. So that's what we're gonna do. So in order to talk about how to generate these finite automata from regular expressions in an automated way, we should probably refresh our knowledge about the theoretical foundations. So let's talk a little bit about the foundations. Let's start with regular expressions. What is the deal with regular expressions? Well, we're talking about the base alphabet, sigma, which is always just a set of different symbols that we're talking about. These are the symbols that our character sequences consist of. That's ASCII code, for example, for programming languages, or whatever you might imagine as a character set. That's captured by our sigma. Unicode is another one of these. And what regular expressions are all about is specifying sets of strings composed of these symbols that come from this alphabet. So we have strings on the basic characters. That's what regular expressions define. A regular expression itself looks like, well, it is an expression on sub-regular expressions. So it is, it can be recursively defined in a way that we have to define the basic components of such a regular expression. That is, for example, the empty string is a regular expression. And all the symbols that are in our alphabet are also already regular expressions. These are the basic components that our regular expressions are made of. And apart from that, regular expressions are composed from sub-regular expressions and a few operators, like this pipe here, the dot, the star, and all that. So regular expressions are are hierarchically composed binary or unary expressions that have this pipe, the dot, and the star. That is the syntactical definition of a regular expression. Examples you find here, so you can compose them in a way that you like. For convenience, we will have certain conventions in the context of the next few slides. We will distinguish between characters from the alphabet. I don't know whether they are so well distinguishable on the board here. But in the recording, you should see a difference between the dark blue and the kind of pink. Yeah. apart from that, you know that the meta symbols are quite limited. There's only parentheses and the pipe symbol, the dot, and the star. And in order to make these regular expressions more clear and more concise, we also want to get rid of these parentheses. So we define a kind of precedence on the operators to minimize the number of parentheses that we need. And well, we say that the star binds more than the dot, and this binds more than the pipe. And also, well, we have one chance of saving space by removing one of these operators, and the one that dominates the others by far in the number of occurrences is the dot operator, so we choose to omit this one and interpret when there's no operator at all that there will be the dot operator. Okay, so now I've talked quite... In practical systems, you will also encounter other operators like the ones here, and you can syntactically transform them into other expressions that mean exactly the same thing. Okay, so that is from a point of a syntactical view a regular expression. Let's have a look at what the semantics of a regular expression is. I've talked about pipes and dots and stars so far. But what do they mean in terms of strings that we want to express with these expressions? Well, if we have these dots, or in this case just expressions one after the other, it means just that I want to concatenate the components that I have written here. So when I just write my regular expression like so, I mean, based on my semantics, that I want to express the set that consists of exactly my components composed one after the other. When I use the pipe symbol like this, this is a kind of an alternative. So when I write A pipe B, I mean either A or B. So I mean the set consisting of A or B, which is just the union of these two components. Yeah, and if I have my my regular expression in a way like this, where I have a star, remember the star is binding most here, so the star is read to be binding on the B. So if I have that, that is something that, which is a little bit more complex. In the terms of sets that I mean by this expression, I mean also several a set consisting of several components. And when I use this star, I mean that I want to encompass all variants of sentences where the operand is repeated in an arbitrary number, meaning that I if I have something like this here, where I have A, B star A, I mean all the sentences that consist of an A in front and an A at the back, and in the middle an arbitrary number of B's. So this is already an infinitely large set that I'm expressing with only one regular expression here. Okay, and if I want to do my whole semantics in a more coordinated, more formal way, I can do that also in a kind of structural way. So the meaning of the empty regular expression is just the empty set, or the set, well, not the empty set, but the set consisting of the empty string. The semantics of just one of my letters from my alphabet is, well, exactly the set that contains only this this letter. When I have the star, star operator. What do I mean? Well, this is meaning I have to interpret first what the E means and then use the star operator, which is on the next page. So have a little more patience here. Then there's the pipe symbol. The pipe symbol between two sub expressions means that I have to unify the sets of strings that belong to the expression E1 and the expression E2. And the dot, what does the dot do? Well, the dot is also an operator on sets of strings and has to be interpreted on the sets that belongs to the E1 and the E2. How do I have to interpret the dot? Well, the dot means that all of the strings that might occur in the first set have to be concatenated to each of the sets that occurs in the second set of strings. So, if my first regular expression sub-expression evaluates to the set L1, and the second one to the set L2, I have to take each W1 from L1 and use it as a prefix to all the strings W2 in L2. So that is what the dot operator means, which is concatenating all the strings from the first set to the strings from the second set. So you have to read, if you read these regular expressions, you have to read the dot or nothing when we omit it as concatenation of two sets of strings. The other one was the star that I've left out so far. This is the clean star. And what does it mean? Well, if L is the set of strings that are covered by the regular expression that was inside was enclosed by the clean star, then with L star I mean all the set of all well, I can have choose from the set L arbitrary elements WI, which I can concatenate as elements of the expressed set of strings. So that's what the clean star does. So you can combine all the elements that you have in the L in an arbitrary number one after each other to create your new set. Okay. So that is what the semantics of the regular expressions are. We can see these regular expressions themselves as being a construct which has a kind of hierarchy as its basic structure. So we can notate them in the form of trees and annotate them with the basic components they are made up from. With the leaves, we have the as leaves. We find the basic symbols that our regular expression is made up from. So all these are leaves, and all the operators are found as inner nodes of the whole thing. So the star, for example, is binding to most of the rest of this thing, so it is in the hierarchy at the very root of the whole thing. And yeah, apart from that, the subtrees characterize the way in which the whole expression is bound to its sub-expression. Okay, so the inner nodes are the operator applications. Good. So, examples for the whole thing. Let's have examples from the specification of Java. Already here for the example, we are using the syntax that a concrete scanner generator for Java is using, which is this JFlex. We will have a few tutorials on JFlex in tutorial sessions, but just for a start here, what would something like JFlex really look like? Well, with JFlex you can define classes for your sets of strings with regular expressions. It uses a little bit of a different syntax that is changing a little bit between practical tools. For our JFlex tool, for example, apart from using the pipe for alternatives of sub-expressions, you will also find something like these braces here to which encompass alternatives also. So instead of using these braces, I could also have written A, B, C, and so on, coming to the Z and starting with A, B, and so on. And these braces here that I can use in this tool enable me to use this minus symbol here to encompass whole spans of characters. So when I write something like this A to Z, I mean all the characters from A to Z, which might be here as alternatives. So, what's also used here is the symbol underscore, and there's also the backslash and the dollar symbol here. So these are all symbols that are grouped into one class of symbol, and they're abbreviated with L here, which comes from letter. So I've defined my letters that I want to use for identifiers, for example. The next regular expression that we see here is a little bit more easy. It is just all the numbers, because it's alternating between 0, 1, 2, till 9. So that is essentially a digit, and that is why it is called DI. So if I want to define a regular expression that expresses my identifiers, I can do that here by, these curly brackets here are escaping the names of other regular expressions that I've already defined before. So with something like this, I mean I want to start with a letter. Then there's an arbitrary repetition of either another letter or a digit. So that is what is essentially standing here. Identifiers start with something that comes from letter class and then can be followed by something which is another letter or a digit. Okay, so that's this is kind of the basics, and pretty simple. But this can grow to be quite ugly. Well, probably you can help me with what this means. Well, the nice thing is that we can process this regular expression just from the start. So, what do you want to start, for example?
Arbitrary number of digits.
So, yes.
Zero or more or one?
Zero. Zero more, yes. Mm-hmm. So you mean this one?
Yes.
Yeah, the dot is overloaded by this, the system with something else. But in this case, when I have this escaped version, it means the dot as an input symbol. You're right. Yes. Okay. Any idea why this is so complicated in this case?
So it's, because it can have multiple forms, an exponential form, or only by point and numbers,
well, there's something as an the exponential form that which is at the very back, but there's several forms that you can specify your.
I think so that you can, for example, say point 1 or 1 point to mean a float, but you can't just say point to mean 0.
Yeah, that's the main problem that you have to face here. Just having a point is not a number at the moment, but you can either have some number there or even arbitrary combinations of numbers, which makes the whole thing to a number, or even have a 0 over here, then all that is a number. Or you might write something like 42 dot, which still is a floating point number. So that is the way why the whole thing is so ridiculously complicated. You need one piece that is fixed, that is the point, but you cannot just write the point alone, because you always need it to be accompanied with some kind of digit, either in front or in the back of the whole thing. So that is why it is encompassed with this complicated alternative production here. Yeah, but apart from that, you can have a prefix or suffix of arbitrary numbers of digits here. And also then there's the suffix, which is dealing with the exponent that you can have here. Yeah, so how do I have to read that? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter which casing I am choosing. Do I have to use plus or minus?
No. Plus or minus or nothing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Be careful. There's the star and there's also this plus thing. We didn't have it too much. This is, yeah, that's exactly the difference to the case that we had before. The plus is always at least one, but you can transform it in a way that you can express the whole thing with star also. But yeah, so that's what the regular expressions in the specifications look like. Yeah, that's for if you want to look at the whole thing at home. Okay, so that is what we use for specification. Now there's what is our actual goal? What do we want to generate? We want to generate finite automata. So what are finite automata? Finite automata are always some kind of graph, and this graph has a certain form. Well, there's nodes that are corresponding to the states of this automaton. There's edges that are transitions between the states of the automaton, and there's labels, and what I mean when I use these labels is that whenever my automaton has a transition from one state to the other, it has to consume the symbol that it finds on the label of this transition. More formally, yeah, I've always put you some portraits of the guys that have, the people that have come up with these concepts when I use these definitions. So that's Michael Rabin and Dana Scott for you. What is an automaton? A non-deterministic finite automaton consists of several components. It has always a set of states. It has an alphabet where it takes its labels from. It inputs input symbols from. Then there's the set of start states where our execution or our consummation of input starts. Then there's certain states that are marked as final states, and also there's a set of a whole relation that tells us which transitions are valid under which input symbols. So that's what I need for a formal automaton. So that's quite nice, but it's still something that's non-deterministic. What would I need to have a deterministic one? What would I need to have a deterministic automaton? What would I have to change? Okay, so let's.
We should have an A state to make it deterministic.
Ah, you need one particular state. Yeah. That's one cause of non-determinism, is that we have here in the non-deterministic form we have a whole set of start states. That's not so good for having deterministic end states afterwards, because we have to check several states at once. So we need to come up with one initial state. But there's also more.
The empty string in there, so we have spontaneous transitions.
Next thing, very well. So what else do we need? Yeah, of course. Yeah, but there's still one thing. We have relations here. So relation does not necessarily mean that I have only with one symbol only one transition from one state. So that's also one thing that makes it, well, that's just another way of expressing something like the empty labels. But anyway. Yeah, we need to make the whole thing be a function rather than a relation in order to get the whole thing straight. So we have another notion of automaton to make it to a deterministic finite automaton. Well, what we need to do is we need to limit our initial states to being only one. We need to have a function instead of a relation for our transitions. And, well, what I have left out here is the empty treatment, but, yeah, that's something that I also would have to do here. Yes, so so much for the kind of formal definition, how the whole thing looks like. Then there's also the thing that what does it mean when I write such an automaton as a graph? Well, the semantics of what I have with my automaton is defined via the computations. That means the paths that can be followed through this automaton. And especially the accepting computations are the ones that are of interest, because those define what the automaton says will be valid inputs for the whole thing. And these valid inputs are called accepted words. And an accepted word is exactly the sequence of labels or symbols that I find when I go through the through my automaton along one of these accepting computations. Yes. So, yeah. In order to define what the semantics of such an automaton is, we need to have a look at all the paths that I can go through such an automaton. And I have to produce them via connecting different possible transitions in this automaton. I can do that with the help of the transitive closure of my transition function. And with the help of that, I can always kind of compose the symbol X to the sequence of symbols that I've already passed when going from P to Q. Exactly, and with this transitive closure, I can define the set of strings that my automaton accepts. When I take all the paths from my closure that start from initial state and end at the final state. So all the words that I can collect when I'm going between the initial state and the final state, I will take into my set of strings that I accept with my automaton. So that's the language that my automaton is accepting. Okay. Most interesting for us is how to come from regular expressions to some kind of automaton. And yeah, I know that there's already a way how to do that you've probably already seen in theoretical informatics, which is this Thompson's algorithm. Next time we will be treating this one as well as a more advanced one, which gives us more nice properties for our automaton. Yeah, that's all for today. I wish you a nice week, nice beginning of the semester, and don't forget to vote for your preferred time slot for the tutorial session.